This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with the Reverend Chris Andrews. For 22 years, he was pastor of the First United Methodist Church. He's now head of Jubilee Pioneers, and he has some ideas to convey regarding Governor Jindal's speech to graduates at Liberty University on Saturday. The governor stated that religious liberty is in jeopardy in the United States. Also on the show, we'll visit with Colonel Rob Maness, the man running for the U.S. Senate is a Republican in the same race as Bill Cassidy, Paul Hollis, and the incumbent Democrat Mary Landrieu. Rob Maness has collected the endorsement of former vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin. We will talk with him about whether this will make a difference in his campaign. And Peter Stark, his book is Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Governor Bobby Jindal addressed graduates of Liberty University over the weekend in Lynchburg, Virginia. He got some national play, and he's playing up his remarks, and we're going to talk about those with the Reverend Chris Andrews, who is head of Jubilee Pioneers here in Baton Rouge, and for more than two decades, he was the pastor at First United Methodist Church. The governor had a very lengthy speech, as he is known to deliver on occasion, but here's a sampling. He says, "I thought about giving a speech telling you of all the great things we're doing in Louisiana, but I knew you would be bored with that. I thought about giving a speech telling you that if you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan, but I decided I didn't want to lie to you. And I thought about giving a speech telling you that debt is good, redistribution of wealth is smart, and personal morality doesn't matter, but you only didn't need to know those things if you're planning to go to work for the federal government in Washington." And so then he gets to the heart of the matter, and he says, "Today the American people, whether they know it or not, are mired in a silent war. It threatens the fabric of our communities, the health of our public square, and the endurance of our constitutional governance. It is a war against the propositions in the Declaration of Independence. It is a war against the spirit that motivated abolitionism. It is a war against the faith that motivated the civil rights struggle. It is a war against the soul of countless acts of charity. It is a war against the conscience that drives social change. It is a war against the heart that binds our neighborhoods together. It is a war against America's best self at America's best moments. It is a war, a silent war, against religious liberty." Those words from the leader of Louisiana for the last 6 years, Governor Bobby Jindal. Reverend Andrews, your thoughts?
I have difficulty understanding where Governor Jindal is coming from when he uses that kind of rhetoric that there is a war against religious liberty. He was, of course, speaking at a very conservative university that was founded by a very prominent proponent of the Christian faith, Reverend Jerry Falwell, and perhaps he was playing to his audience. But as I live and breathe and move about our society, as a religious person and as a person of deep conviction, I cannot say that I see that there's some kind of war against people practicing their faith in any fashion in this country.
Well, Jerry Falwell passed away almost 7 years ago, but I'm sure he was smiling from afar.
I think he was. And you may remember that Jerry Falwell started something called the Moral Majority.
Yes, he did.
And there's a kind of irony in that, Jim, I believe, in that biblically, the majority is usually wrong. And it's the minority that saves. The prophetic movement was a minority movement. Jesus was a minority and got crucified for his efforts. It is seldom the large voice that represents the voice of God. If we look back on it from a perspective of history, it's always the small voice and the silent voice. And I think that Governor Jindal wants to be a part of the large voice, is in some ways a part of the large voice, got a very big microphone, and he's reflecting a perspective that simply does not wash from a historical perspective or even, I think, from a current experiential perspective.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. inksterhow at wrkf.org if you would like to reach us online. The Reverend Chris Andrews, who says the governor is off target just a bit in his statements at Liberty University on Saturday before the graduates of the school founded by the Reverend Jerry Falwell. The advocate's take on this was that Jindal poked fun at his alma mater during the speech. Graduate of Brown University, as we know, he says it's said that college is an intellectual pursuit involving reason and logic. One of the good things about going to Brown is that I was able to become the president of the college Republicans on campus almost immediately. The other Republican student at Brown was the vice president.
Yeah. Well, I think he has the right to do that. And it's kind of
that's
light
okay.
Humor. Sure,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
fine.
Yeah,
that's
a
just
little
fine.
Self-deprecating
certainly
humor every now and
nothing
then
wrong with that.
Is good. He also said that the biggest moment in his life was when he converted to Christianity.
Yes, I found that interesting. I listened to the speech online and found that to be quite interesting. In which he makes that kind of statement. And it makes me kind of wonder how Governor Jindal, out of that perspective, embraces diversity, if he does embrace diversity. It's just an interesting kind of perspective and an interesting theological position that he brings in his life. I don't fault him for having that, but I do offer a word of caution to him as a man with a pulpit as large as his is, to be sensitive to people who don't walk the same halls he walks and don't see things in the same perspective that he sees them. That doesn't make them incorrect, wrong, or illegitimate, though in some ways I think that the essence of his message to the Liberty University students as well as in other places is just that, that if you don't see it my way, you're not right. You're wrong.
His own parents are not Christian.
His own parents are not Christian, I understand. I'm sure they're fine people, and from my perspective, they are children of God, loved of God, as worthy of any blessings of God as anyone else.
Including heaven?
Including heaven, yes.
Bill in East Baton Rouge. Bill, you're on the air with the Reverend Andrews. Good morning, sir.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Two thoughts. One, I'm really tired of hearing people refer to any disagreement or any political difference in stance as a war. We're not in a war. I personally have never been in a war, but I certainly know enough to know that we are not in a war. It's just such an overly used and misused phrase. Secondly, your guest mentioned the possibility that Jindal may have been playing to the base there. That's what he has been doing since he became governor, is playing to the base with an aim at running for president. I'll take your comments off. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bill. I think you're very perceptive, and I agree with you. And I think your sensitivity about using such terms as war is to be noted. It's a brutal term, and I don't think that when we're in debate or just simply discussion with different opinions, that's a war.
The governor in his speech, a few other items are worth mentioning. He says the freedom to exercise your religion in the way you run your business, large or small, is under assault.
Well, he was, of course, referring to the Hobby Lobby controversy that has of late been in the news. I don't think that it's under assault at all. I think that one of the things about America that makes this a great country is that we have established institutional rights for everybody. And in doing so, it becomes uncomfortable sometimes when I'm so convinced of the rightness of my position, my place, and then I have to make room for somebody else who disagrees with me or I disagree with. There's a good example, Jim, in today's news, an individual who is cited for referencing companies that are run by Jews, and therefore they were illegitimate because they were Jewish people. That kind of attitude is abhorrent and has always been. If there's something anti-American, that's an anti-American attitude. Without intending, I think, sometimes people with strong conviction foster that very anti-American attitude, to believe that we have a unique perspective on what is right, and anyone who disagrees or varies from our perspective is automatically discounted and labeled as illegitimate. That is anti-American.
Well, the governor says you've likely heard of the Obama administration's case against Hobby Lobby, a mega craft store and a family business whose battle against President Obama's contraception mandate will end up as a Supreme Court decision. The national chain filed suit after being told they would be fined $1.3 million per day if they did not pay for abortifacients through their insurance. Is that depriving Hobby Lobby of religious liberty?
I am certainly not an attorney and not a constitutional scholar, but it seems to me that when you are in the public sphere, you have to honor the diversity of the public, and you cannot force your particular viewpoint and ask others to adhere to it, reap the benefits of your corporate success, and then have your own way. It just doesn't work that way.
Bill in East Baton Rouge, thank you for your remarks. Jim on I-10. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Jim. I want to thank the good Lord for the Reverend's viewpoint on this ridiculous position of the governor. I would like to say that the governor is acting as all Republicans have for the past 20 years. I don't believe that they have done much except exploit emotionalism. The only thing they can talk about during an election is gays, abortion, Christianity, and at the same time, they're supporting offshoring of jobs that are ruining the country. The man has no morals, I don't think.
All right. Let's not launch a personal attack against the governor. He's inclined to have the right to have his beliefs, too.
He certainly is. But I think that the thing that is the sort of fly in the ointment with Governor Jindal is that if you look at his performance as a governor, it's pretty consistent that if you don't agree with him, you're out. Now, he is, in my opinion, saying, in essence, that's the same thing he's fussing about the Obama administration or the Supreme Court or this big boogie boo that is the federal government that he so, you know, seemingly wants to be the head of. It's either see it my way,
well,
or that's it.
That's a very fundamentalist point of view.
Exactly.
I once worked for the Reverend Jimmy Swaggart, who I liked, by the way, and treated me fairly, but I was a Roman Catholic, and to him, I think the Roman Catholic Church was as evil as any organization in the world, in his opinion.
That's exactly right. There are quarters that would look on our Catholic brothers and sisters as, just agents of the devil. It's amazing. Traditional pastor from the pulpit of First Methodist, a fine church in the center of our city, I said on more than one occasion, we would be better off without religion. I wish we could just sort of throw it all into the sea. But we're incurably religious, so we ought to have good religion.
Sounding like John Lennon now.
Yeah, well, we really are. We're incurably religious, so we ought to have good religion. That's what my little group, Jubilee Pioneers, is trying to do. By the way, we meet tonight at 7 o'clock at Cafe American.
You may have quite a crowd there.
Well, I don't know, but practicing good religion, which is buttressed, I think, by compassion and love. Love and compassion. Seems to me that that's what it's all about. That's what Jesus seems to have been about. And one of the most dangerous, dangerous things that human beings need to be aware of is limited perspective. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, if the light in you is darkness, great indeed is the darkness. I grew up in a segregated world, saw nothing wrong with that because nobody ever called it to my attention. That's the darkness. I didn't know it was dark. It seemed normal to me. And I think that Governor Jindal needs to have a little more light in order to sort of temper some of the dogmatic statements he offers.
Well, he spoke of light, too. These are his final remarks Saturday in his commencement address. America has had enough people who see themselves as victims. You should go out in the world and be salt and light. And most of all, you should be bold in your faith. Embrace opportunities to stand up for the truth. You never know when you might be planting a seed that will change someone's life forever. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We continue with the Reverend Chris Andrews commenting on Governor Jindal's speech to graduates at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. It's nice that the governor of Louisiana is courted to appear at events of this kind. And, of course, if and when he becomes the 45th American president, he quite likely will be speaking at other commencement venues. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air with Chris Andrews. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Reverend Andrews. I find it humorous to listen to our governor who had the religious freedom to come here as a Hindu and had the religious freedom to become a Christian as he chose. So I'm trying to understand what basis he's using. But, Pastor, you mentioned that Jesus Christ earlier, and you know, as a man of the word, that Christ spent more time healing the poor than he did trying to convert them and preach to them. Yet we have a governor who's turned his back on the poor and the sick with his refusal to expand Medicaid. So the Bible says we should be judged by the fruit we bear.
Well, you're right, Charles. The fruit is the most important thing, and faith without works is dead. And to be a follower of Jesus Christ, I think, is to try to enact measures of compassion and love that Jesus was really all about in his earthly life. And followers of Jesus Christ sometimes forget that a disciple has to do what the master has said and see instead Jesus as a kind of ticket to a glorious afterlife with a little consequence to how we live our life in the here and now. That's sad.
297-5633 is your number. There is a line open for the first time in a while for the Reverend Chris Andrews, and we'll get to a few more people as well as we continue our discussion with the Reverend Andrews about Governor Jindal going before an extremely conservative crowd at Liberty University, a Christian university founded by the head of the Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell, and Governor Jindal said in his speech, and it was touted by his PR office, by the way, as well. The excerpts that they sent out early indicated that the governor would talk about an assault on religious liberty in this country, and the governor, my guess, really believes this, and he also believes it sells well with the right wing of the Republican Party. This is not only, I think, part of his inner being, but it's also a political strategy.
Yeah, I think the governor probably is sincere in his belief about his perspective. One of the things that struck me as I listened to the speech, Jim, is that there's a kind of attitude of haughtiness there in that toward the end of the speech, the governor used the words, "We have established," meaning all the remarks that he had provided before, "We have established, we have established." And then it was this truth that he was trying to build a case for that he thought he had established in his remarks. I personally, respectfully, don't think that he did, and I think that his reading of history is somewhat flawed, and I wish that he would engage in conversations with people just for the benefit of expanding perspective and horizons who disagree with him.
Henry Johnson at the Country Club, he pointed out that Ted Kennedy spoke at Liberty University to their graduates, same event, 1983, 31 years ago. By the way, I remember when this happened, Jerry Falwell invited him, and he didn't think Ted Kennedy would take him up on it.
I was not aware of that.
And I you can pull up Kennedy's remarks, and here to give you an example of how different they are to Governor Jindal's, here's a paragraph from Kennedy's remarks to the students at Liberty University who were graduating 31 years ago. "I am mindful of the council. I am an American and a Catholic. I love my country and treasure my faith, but I do not assume that my conception of patriotism or policy is invariably correct, or that my convictions about religion should command any greater respect than any other faith in this pluralistic society. I believe there surely is such a thing as truth, but who among us can claim a monopoly on it?" That was not in Governor Jindal's speech.
That was not in his speech, and that certainly was not the sentiment of Governor Jindal's speech. It was quite the opposite, in fact. I find Kennedy's words quite humble words. I did not know he'd spoken there.
Well, if you ask Governor Jindal about Ted Kennedy, he would disagree, I would think.
I would think he would, yeah.
And if he did agree with him, he'd say a stop clock is right twice a day, right?
That's right. Okay. That's right. Okay. Yeah.
297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. Ed on Highland Road. Ed, good morning. You're on with Chris Andrews.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, sir.
And Chris.
Good morning.
I've been listening to your comments, Chris, and it seems to be a matter of tolerance. Governor General went to this community to speak, and he spoke certainly the sentiments of that university. And so why is he criticized for it?
I'm not criticizing the governor for what he says or for what he thinks. What I take issue with is that the governor is a person who stands in a what has been called a bully pulpit, and his words are often words that are the framework for public policy or policy that he would like to see shaped. So I think that words by people in his office and of that status of the public sphere are very powerful things and need to be looked at, analyzed, thought about, and just appreciated for the power that they bring to the table.
What do you think, Ed?
To express his feelings. They're his heartfelt feelings. They're his sincerity. Mm-hmm. Just as much as the people at Hobby Lobby have their convictions, and why should not their convictions be honored? And we could go on to other examples of people that have personal, moral, religious convictions that are not being allowed to express them. Why is that not tolerated?
I certainly wish for everyone to have the opportunity to express their feelings. However, expressing feelings does not validate feelings or convictions or political persuasions. And there, you know, throughout history and the history of this country, there's been a kind of continual evolution of our understanding of, for example, the founders' image that all people are created equal, et cetera, et cetera. When those words were uttered, they are beautiful words that, you know, are almost holy words to Americans. But we've had to live into those words, and we've had to live up to them. And I'm just using that as a kind of example that sometimes just people's feelings or perspective just aren't the feeling and perspective that we need to let go unchallenged or unanalyzed, because the reality is that the world is larger than our own perspectives and our feelings.
297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Chris Andrews, the longtime pastor in Baton Rouge, now head of Jubilee
Pioneers.
Pioneers.
Yeah.
The meeting tonight at 7 o'clock at Cafe American.
That's correct. And the pioneer piece of that, Jim, is an interesting part of our name, in that what we say with humility is we're simply trying to pioneer good religion in this world, blaze trails that are guided by love and compassion, welcoming all, and seeing every face, as an image of God's own presence in our life and world.
I remember you being on this show on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade last year, the 40th mm-hmm. anniversary,
right.
And Sally Campbell was on the other line, and you were talking like this, and she said, "Pastor, Pastor."
She did. She didn't see my perspective. That's okay. Ms. Campbell's a fine lady. And
I imagine Governor Jindal, if he's listening right now, saying the same thing.
Yeah, I guess he's shaking his head. I do know the governor. He and I have worked together across the years, and you know, I would count him as a friend, somebody I have regard for.
Daryl sends an email. It says, to the lengthy list of adjectives often used to describe Governor Jindal, we can now add the words paranoid and delusional. Does Reverend Andrews have any thoughts about whether Governor Jindal has come psychologically unhinged? I wouldn't go that far.
No, I would not say so. I think that, as we said earlier, I think the governor is very sincere in his perspective and his beliefs. I just wish he'd examine it, because it does not work very well in the world that we live in, and it leads to some rather unfortunate places, I think.
HB in Denham Springs. HB, good morning. You're on with Chris Andrews. Hi, HB.
Good morning. Reverend Chris, I've heard many of your colleagues who, in one form or another to their flock, including the Reverend Billy Graham, saying over the years that our society has become a moral and ethical junkyard, from the television shows that we see to unethical behavior in the home all the way to the classroom. What is your opinion on what they're bringing to their flock? Thank you, sir.
I think that, HB, thank you for your comment. If you would look at a historical perspective, almost every era has had its lament that this is the worst that things have ever been, and that never have we been as morally unhinged or morally misdirected as we are now. Certainly every era has its issues and has its problems, and we certainly have ours today. But I just choose to believe that the world is not, forgive this, but going to hell in a handbasket. I think that there is a perspective that carries the day for decency and for civility, and that this is a great country that we've got, and it has withstood lots of stresses and strains, and it's going to withstand the stresses and strain of today, and we'll go on, pass the torch on to those who come after us, and they'll be clicking their heels and shaking their heads and lamenting the condition of their own time. It's just the human story over and over.
Well, Governor Jindal is not afraid to draw lines. He says their vision of America is not the vision of the founding. It's not even the vision of 10 years ago. It's a vision in which an individual's devotion to Almighty God is accorded as much respect as a casual hobby and with about as many rights and protections. These elites have to this point face little opposition, but there is a remnant who have the temerity, I think that should be who has the temerity, to believe in America and its promises and to do something about it. Will you be part of that remnant? Chris Andrews, he's calling you to action.
I hope I'll be part of the remnant, but I suspect that the governor and I will have a different perspective about what that looks like and what action should be taken and what position should be embraced. And part of what I have trouble with some of that rhetoric of the governors, and I speak in lots of settings, and I know how difficult it is to do that, and I appreciate that he can do it and do it well, but is the kind of lines of division that you've cited, Jim, and the labeling, elites, the left. I wish we'd get rid of that language and just sort of talk about issues that concern us all and try to practice a civility that allows the conversation to be heard. The person I most need to listen to is the person I most severely disagree with. That's the way we grow. That's the way we learn.
Maybe you and the governor should get together.
I'd love to sit down with the governor.
Okay. He says, will churches in America even be able to remain part of the public square in a time when their views on sin are in direct conflict with the culture and when expressing those views will be seen as hiding hateful speech behind religious protections? This war on religious liberty, on your freedom to exercise your religion, on your freedom to associate, on your freedom of expression, is only going to continue. It's going to continue because of an idea, a wrong-headed concept, that religious freedom means you have the freedom to worship, and that's all.
Well, that's certainly not the way it is in Louisiana, is it? I mean, we have such organizations as the Louisiana Family Forum that wields a pretty heavy hand in our legislature, and in fact, it's embarrassing to me that we can't even get removed from our statutes a law that is, you know, blatantly unconstitutional, totally irrelevant, but it cannot be done because the Louisiana Family Forum stands up and says it's a symbol that we want to keep in front of us and as a people in this state. So don't talk to me about the curtailing of religious freedom, especially if you're from Louisiana. Religion is alive and well and used, I think, as a pretty heavy club. And for some very unfortunate reasons.
Well, thank you, Chris Andrews. Always good to talk with
Jim,
you.
Jim, thank you. It's good to be with you. You're a breath of fresh air in our community, and let's try practicing good religion. Jubilee Pioneers, 7 o'clock tonight. Hope you come.
And like we Catholics, you have a little wine with the ceremony, don't you?
If you can afford it, you can have it. We don't serve it, but you can have it.
And now we're joined by the Colonel, Rob Manus, the man who's running for the United States Senate, trying to unseat Mary Landrieu out there in the Republican primary with, actually, it's an open primary featuring Republicans, Democrats, and whatever else, but he's in there with Bill Cassidy and with Paul Hollis. Good morning, Colonel Manus.
Hey, good morning, Jim. It's good to be back on.
Well, we're going to get to Sarah Palin, but do you think religious liberty is under assault in this country today?
Oh, I think so. I think Governor Jindal's rhetoric has some value to it. You know, I mean, I agree with your previous guest, though we have to have an environment of stability in order to be able to come to the right perspective on these kinds of issues. We have to acknowledge that religious liberty also includes the ability to not be religious, and that's what the founders designed for us to be able to do. But if we don't get away from labeling all sides and the middle, then it'd be very difficult to continue or even start a civil conversation.
Well, Colonel Manus, you have been in Louisiana for how long now?
I first came here in 1987. So,
okay, 87.
You know, when I count up all the time, yeah, that's right.
Okay, so in 88, my guess is that you voted for president that year, and your two major candidates in the same race you're in, Mary Landrieu and Bill Cassidy in 1988, in the race that featured Michael Dukakis and George Bush, they both voted for Michael Dukakis, at least they say they did. Cassidy proudly wrote letters to the editor supporting Governor Dukakis for president of the United States. Who did you vote for in 1988?
I voted for George H.W. Bush. Who I voted for.
So 26 years later, does that really mean anything?
Does it really mean anything?
Yeah, the fact that Cassidy, who's the leading Republican in the race, according to polls, was a Dukakis Democrat many years ago.
Well, I think it means something if you take a look at somebody's voting record in Congress and from when they've been in politics, and that voting record implies that they still think the same way.
All right, we just cut off the colonel, and we apologize to him, and hopefully he will call back. Colonel Rob Manus is a gentleman who is campaigning as somewhat of a Tea Party candidate, and he got the support over the last week of Governor Sarah Palin, the former governor of Alaska, who is John McCain's running mate in 2008, who is the conservative's conservative, and Sarah Palin is backing Rob Manus in his quest to unseat Mary Landrieu. And Rob Manus says, unlike Congressman Cassidy, he voted for George H.W. Bush in 1988. Congressman Cassidy at that time was a Dukakis supporter, writing letters to the editor attacking Ronald Reagan. We'll talk more with Colonel Manus when we return after this brief timeout. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Colonel Rob Manus. And before we get to the endorsement from Governor Palin, we were back in 1988. And whether you thought this was relevant, that you supported George H.W. Bush in the presidential election of 88, and Congressman Cassidy backed Michael Dukakis.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate that. I think what makes it relevant is, you know, as I've driven through all 64 parishes in the state with my team, the folks that I talk to on the ground that are concerned about this election and have that as an issue for themselves are really concerned, because if someone is going to put themselves out there as the conservative savior of a state in the U.S. Senate, then that makes them uncomfortable. Especially when they take a closer look at their voting record, and that voting record may not be exactly conservative in their minds. So I think that's what makes it relevant. I think it makes it relevant since I've been a Republican all my life, and I was a young conservative, you know. And so I wasn't a liberal when I was young. I was a conservative when I was young, and I was pulled into the Republican Party by Ronald Reagan. Well, and I think that makes a difference to the voters of Louisiana.
12 years ago, 2002, not so long ago, Congressman Cassidy in a U.S. Senate race that included Mary Landrieu and Tony Perkins and John Cooksey and Susie Terrell, Congressman Cassidy supported Mary Landrieu. Who did you support? Do you recall?
No, I don't recall that particular race.
Was it Senator Landrieu?
Again, I don't recall who I supported in that particular race.
Could it have been Senator Landrieu?
I doubt it. I seriously doubt it.
Okay.
I haven't voted for a Democrat my entire voting life that I remember.
That's a long time.
That is a long time. That's why I'm only human. So, you know, nobody's perfect. My memory could be faulty, but not that I remember.
Well, it sounds like you think the congressman might be a suspect conservative.
Well, you know, I mean, you just have to look at the record, Jim, and that's all I can go on. I'm not judging the congressman's service. I really respect his service. I respect Senator Landrieu's service to the nation. All I'm questioning is, and what people are telling me they're concerned about, is that if we're going to be the conservative savior and you expect to be able to defeat somebody like Senator Landrieu, you better have the right armor on and the right shield. And when you have documented cases where you have not done that, it's going to make it that much more difficult to defeat her.
Well, I saw Tony Perkins, one of the fellows I mentioned who ran against Senator Landrieu in 2002. I saw him a few weeks ago in Washington, just by chance, by the way, and a very nice man. But I asked him about the Senate race, and I told him I thought Mary Landrieu was going to have a tough time winning. And he said, Jim, if it comes down to Landrieu and Cassidy, moderates don't beat liberals. That's from Tony Perkins.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Is he backing you?
He hasn't come into the race yet. I know that I've had discussions with him. We see eye to eye on all the issues that I'm aware of, and I would love to have his support.
Okay.
And I think that's why I've got Governor Palin.
Well, what about that? Does that mean anything in Louisiana, the fact that Sarah Palin, who was not highly regarded in some quarters, is backing you for the U.S. Senate?
Well, I think I'm very honored and grateful to get the endorsement of somebody like a former GOP vice presidential candidate, governor of Alaska, a strong woman in politics that has basically come from one of us. And I think that her support is going to make a difference. Already has made a difference. We've seen an uptick in donations online, at least, and with the name recognition, you know, with the media, the earned media, name recognition gets out there and those kinds of things. For a candidate like me that started at the grassroots level 11 months ago, and it, like I said, is driven through every parish, but hasn't been able to talk to every Louisianan or hasn't been on TV, that every little bit's going to help. And I think it's going to have an overall positive effect.
297-5633. We just have a minute or two left with Colonel Maness, who's been campaigning vigorously. He had stops this weekend in the greater New Orleans area, and I must say you're trying hard, despite those who say that the odds are strong against your success. Evan on Corporate Boulevard. Evan, good morning. You're on with Colonel Maness.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask the guest, what was his thoughts on compromise in the legislative process? Governor Palin has often said that compromise is such a dirty word. So I just wanted to make sure that whoever is running, we're not paying another individual $170,000 to go to Washington, D.C. just to vote no for everything. I mean, anybody can pretty much do that. So will you be a candidate of compromise?
I'm a candidate of.
Sorry?
I'm a candidate of constitutional principle. I have said many times in all of my meetings when I'm asked about compromise that I am perfectly willing to sit down at the table and discuss solutions to problems. what I refuse to compromise on is constitutional principle. There's a reason why we have the greatest country in the history of mankind called the United States of America. And it is because of that Constitution of the United States. That is what's made us an economic powerhouse early in our history. That it, and that fact has led us to be this great country that we have today. And part of the challenges that we face today are because we haven't always stayed on constitutional principle, and we have made some compromises that we shouldn't have made. And that's where I'm coming from. So compromise is not necessarily a dirty word. Just let's not compromise on the Constitution and the principles behind it.
Well, thank you, Colonel Maness. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Take care. 297-5633 is your number, and we're joined by Peter Stark. He's the author of a number of books. He's written for the Smithsonian and New Yorker, among other publications. He lives in Montana, and his book is Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. And this is quite a ride. 6 years after Lewis and Clark's journey began its journey to the Pacific Northwest, two of the Eastern establishment's leading figures, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson, turned their sights to founding a colony akin to Jamestown on the West Coast and transforming the nation into a Pacific trading power. Good morning, Peter Stark.
Good morning, Jim. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, good to hear from you. It's a true adventure tale of the 1810 Astor Expedition, an epic. Why have we not heard more about this through the years?
Well, it's really a forgotten chapter in American history, and there are a couple of reasons we haven't heard much about it. It came at a pivotal moment in U.S. history, and had things turned out slightly differently, and some different leadership decisions had been made, the continent might look very different today. The reason we haven't heard about it, for a couple of reasons that come to mind, one is that it's been so overshadowed by the Lewis and Clark expedition and the great success they had. This was the expedition that came right after Lewis and Clark, and in a way it had a much weightier role, a much more significant mission, which was to found this colony on the West Coast. And in fact, Thomas Jefferson wanted it to be a separate democracy, a separate country on the West Coast, and John Jacob Astor saw it as this big trans-global, trans-Pacific trade empire. And this was at a time when the West Coast was just wild, wild, remote terrain, except for, of course, Native American tribes. And another reason it's been forgotten is that it ultimately didn't resolve the question about what would happen to the West Coast and the Northwest. Didn't ultimately resolve for about 40 years. So the question ended up hanging in limbo. There was not a clear resolution to it. But there's a great story about what happened during this period, 1810 to 1813, when the U.S. was trying to establish itself as a great Pacific power.
This was 7 years after the start of the expedition, but 7 years after the Louisiana Purchase. That certainly influenced this.
Exactly. It influenced it very much, and you all in Louisiana, I mean, are intimately connected with that history. That, as you know, that Jefferson was president, Thomas Jefferson, president 1800, acquired the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, which extended U.S. territory, up through the Mississippi Valley to the crest of the Rocky Mountains. And, of course, at this point, the entire U.S. was, very fledgling country, and the population was really clustered along the eastern seaboard and down your way. So there were very, very little population out in the Louisiana Purchase itself. Between the crest of the Rockies, where the Louisiana Purchase ended, and the Pacific coast, there was an area that was still unclaimed by Western powers, an area that's, roughly the size of Europe. And that's more or less what John Jacob Astor, who is a fur trader from New York, a young, ambitious fur trader, targeted that area the size of Europe on the West Coast.
The New York Times, in its review of Astoria, writes, Stark's delightful narrative is proof that even though Astor didn't leave the legacy he intended, his grand failure certainly deserves its own place in history. And he backed the enterprise with much of his fortune, didn't he?
He did, yeah. And, I mean, he had this scheme. It was just this amazingly well-thought-out, ambitious scheme, this trans-global trading scheme. And what he was doing was taking trade goods from – he had a fleet of ships, a fleet of sailing ships. He'd take that fleet of sailing ships, send them from New York with trade goods around the tip of South America to the northwest coast, and establish a great trading emporium, he called it, at the mouth of the Columbia River near between Portland and Seattle in today's geography. And from there, he would trade these trinkets, these beads and pots and knives to the coastal Indians who live there for sea otter furs and other furs, and take those furs on his ships across the Pacific to China. And those furs were extremely valuable in China. The Chinese mandarins used sea otter fur to trim their robes, and sea otter is still the most luxurious mammal fur known. It's there's a million square hairs per square inch. He could sell those at enormous profit in China, and then use those profits to buy in China Chinese luxury goods like teas and silks and porcelains, load his fleet of ships with the Chinese luxury goods, send them the rest of the way around the world to London and New York, and sell those luxury goods at another huge markup in London and New York. So he has a fleet of ships continuously circling the world, making huge profits at every stop. So he had this vision of both the Pacific as a center of world power and commerce way, way, way before other people did. And likewise, Jefferson had that vision of the Pacific as a source of world power. And Astor had this global trading vision very early.
Mm-hmm. Well, they established Fort Astoria, a trading post on the Columbia River, and did so within, about a year of the start of the expedition. What happened at Fort Astoria?
Well, it was not an easy establishment due to the extreme remoteness. And Astor, as you say, he was willing to back this with enormous resources, and he did have enormous resources. He sent out two advance parties to establish Fort Astoria, one overland party up across the continent up the Lewis and Clark route, and one by sea around Cape Horn, around the tip of South America. Well, the overland party was led by a young New Jersey businessman named Wilson Price Hunt, who was, serious, sober-minded, very loyal to Astor, but had one big drawback as a leader, and that is he'd never been in the wilderness before. And he was leading a party across the continental wilderness. That caused all sorts of problems. The other expedition, the seagoing expedition, was led by a young U.S. naval hero named Captain Jonathan Thorne, who was fearless in battle against enemy ships, but this was the first time he'd ever commanded a commercial ship. And he had a ship that was full of Scottish fur traders and French-Canadian voyageurs, to establish this Fort Astoria, and they immediately ran into massive personality conflicts the first night out of New York Harbor when Thorne told everybody lights out 8 o'clock, and the shaggy Scottish fur traders and French Canadian voyageurs said, no, we're not done smoking our pipes and talking. And Thorne said, yes, you are. It's lights out, military discipline. And they said, no, we're not. In fact, Astor gave us shares in the Enterprise, so we actually own part of this ship. Captain Thorne said, the first man who disobeys my orders or my own ship, I'm going to blow his brains out. Hmm. And relations deteriorated from there. So that kind of marked this whole enterprise had leadership difficulties. These leaders who were in very difficult situations in very remote areas of the West Coast.
Well, Peter, of those who started the expedition, how many stayed the course? How many made it to?
Well, out of 140 in these two advance parties, about nearly half of them, about 65, died violently on the way on the way out there, And that's, you know, compared to Lewis and Clark, who there were 30 men in Lewis and Clark's party, and they all survived with the exception of one, who Floyd Lewis, who died of appendicitis. So you can see the difference in scale of these expeditions, and also the disaster that befell this Astor expedition.
The book is Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. Thank you so much, Peter Stark.
Thank you.
Take care, and we'll talk soon, I hope.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim.
And we'll be back tomorrow.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.